Chapter 9. After 2 weeks of nearly constant work, Ed Frank Custom Jewelry had produced its first finished batch. There the pieces lay, on two boards covered with black velvet, all of which went into a square wicker basket of Japanese origin. And Ed McCarthy and Frank Frink had made business cards. They had used an art gum eraser carved out to form their name. They printed in red from this, and then completed the cards with a children's toy rotary printing set. The effect, they had used a high-quality Christmas card-colored heavy paper, was striking. In every aspect of their work, they had been professional. Surveying their jewelry, cards, and display, they could see no indication of the amateur. Why should there be? Frank Frink thought. We're both pros, not in jewelry making, but in shop work in general. The display boards held a good variety. Cuff bracelets made of brass, copper, bronze, and even hot-forged black iron. Pendants, mostly of brass, with a little silver ornamentation. Earrings of silver, pins of silver or brass. The silver had cost them a good deal. Even silver solder had set them back. They had bought a few semi-precious stones, too, for mounting in the pins. Baroque pearls, spinels, jade, slivers of fire opal. And if things went well, they would try gold and possibly 5 or 6 point diamonds. It was gold that would make them a real profit. They had already begun searching into sources of scrap gold, melted down antique pieces of no artistic value, much cheaper to buy than new gold. But even so, an enormous expense was involved. And yet, one gold pin sold would bring more than 40 brass pins. They could get almost any price on the retail market for a really well-designed and executed gold pin, assuming, as Frink had pointed out, that their stuff went over at all. At this point, they had not yet tried to sell. They had solved what seemed to be their basic technical problems. They had their bench, with motors, flex cable machine, arbor of grinding and polishing wheels. They had, in fact, a complete range of finishing tools, ranging from the coarse wire brushes through brass brushes and cratex wheels to finer polishing buffs of cotton, linen, leather, chamois, which could be coated with compounds ranging from emery and pumice to the most delicate rouges. And, of course, they had their oxyacetylene welding outfit, their tanks, gauges, hoses, tips, masks, and superb jeweler's tools. Pliers from Germany and France, micrometers, diamond drills, saws, tongs, tweezers, third-hand structures for soldering, vices, polishing cloths, shears, hand-forged tiny hammers, rows of precision equipment, and their supplies of brazing rod of various gauge, sheet metal, pinbacks, links, earring clipbacks. Well over half the $2,000 had been spent. They had, in their Ed Frank bank account, only $250 now. But they were set up legally. They even had their PSA permits. Nothing remained but to sell. No retailer, Frank thought as he studied the displays, can give these a tougher inspection than we have. They certainly looked good, these few select pieces, each painstakingly gone over for bad welds, rough or sharp edges, spots of fire color. Their quality control was excellent. The slightest dullness or wire brush scratch had been enough reason to return a piece to the shop. We can't afford to show any crude or unfinished work. One unnoticed black speck on a silver necklace, and we're finished. On their list, Robert Childen's store appeared first. But only Ed could go there. Childen would certainly remember Frank Frink.
You got to do most of the actual selling, Ed said. But he was resigned to approaching Childen himself.
He had bought a good suit, new tie, white shirt, to make the right impression. Nonetheless, he looked ill at ease.
I know we're good, he said for the millionth time. But, hell.
Most of the pieces were abstract, whirls of wire, loops, designs which to some extent the molten metals had taken on their own. Some had a spiderweb delicacy, an airiness. Others had a massive, powerful, almost barbaric heaviness. There was an amazing range of shape, considering how few pieces lay on the velvet trays. And yet one store, Frink realized, could buy everything we have laid out here. We'll see each store once, if we fail. But if we succeed, if we get them to carry our line, we'll be going back to refill orders the rest of our lives. Together, the two of them loaded the velvet board trays into the wicker basket. We could get something back on the metal, Frink said to himself, if worse comes to worst. And the tools and equipment. We can dispose of them at a loss, but at least we'll get something.
This is the moment to consult the Oracle. Ask, how will Ed make out on his first selling trip?
But he was too nervous to. It might give a bad omen, and he did not feel capable of facing it. In any case, the die was cast. The pieces were made, the shop set up, whatever the I Ching might blab out at this point. It can't sell our jewelry for us.
It can't give us luck.
I'll tackle Children's Place first, Ed said. We might as well get it over with, and then you can try a couple.
You're coming along, aren't you?
In the truck. I'll park around the corner.
As they got into their pickup truck with their wicker hamper, Frink thought, God knows how good a salesman Ed is, or I am. Children can be sold, but it's going to take a presentation, like they say.
If Juliana were here, he thought, she could stroll in there and do it without batting an eye. She's pretty, she can talk to anybody on earth, and she's a woman. After all, this is women's jewelry. She could wear it into the store.
Shutting his eyes, he tried to imagine how she would look with one of their bracelets on, or one of their large silver necklaces, with her black hair and her pale skin, doleful, probing eyes, wearing a gray jersey sweater, a little bit too tight, the silver resting against her bare flesh, metal rising and falling as she breathed. God, she was vivid in his mind right now. Every piece they made, the strong, thin fingers picked up, examined, tossing her head back, holding the piece high, Juliana sorting, always a witness to what he had done. Best for her, he decided, would be earrings, the bright dangly ones, especially the brass, with her hair held back by a clip or cut short so that her neck and ears could be seen. And we could take photos of her for advertising and display. He and Ed had discussed a catalog, so they could sell by mail to stores in other parts of the world. She would look terrific. Her skin is nice, very healthy, no sagging or wrinkles, and a fine color.
Would she do it if I could locate her?
No matter what she thinks of me, nothing to do with our personal life. This would be a strictly business matter. Hell, I wouldn't even take the pictures. We'd get a professional photographer to do it.
That would please her. Her vanity probably as great as always. She always liked people to look at her, admire her. Anybody. I guess most women are like that. They crave attention all the time. They're very babyish that way. He thought, Juliana could never stand being alone. She had to have me around all the time, complimenting her. Little kids are that way. They feel if their parents aren't watching what they do, then what they do isn't real. No doubt she's got some guy noticing her right now, telling her how pretty she is, her legs, her smooth, flat stomach.
What's the matter? Ed said, glancing at him.
Losing your nerve?
No, Frink said.
I'm not just going to stand there, Ed said. I've got a few ideas of my own, and I'll tell you something else. I'm not scared. I'm not intimidated just because it's a fancy place and I have to put on this fancy suit. I admit I don't like to dress up. I admit I'm not comfortable, but that doesn't matter a bit. I'm still going in there and really give it to that poophead.
Good for you, Frink thought.
Hell, if you could go in there like you did, Ed said, and give him that line about being a Jap Admiral's gentleman, I ought to be able to tell him the truth, that this is really good, creative, original handmade jewelry, that...
Hand-wrought, Frink said.
Yeah, hand-wrought. I mean, I'll go in there and I won't come back out until I've given him a run for his money. He ought to buy this. If he doesn't, he's really nuts. I've looked around. There isn't anything like ours for sale anywhere. God, when I think of him maybe looking at it and not buying it, it makes me so goddamn mad I could start swinging.
Make sure you tell him it's not plated, Frink said. That copper means solid copper, and brass, solid brass.
You let me work out my own approach, Ed said. I got some really good ideas.
Frink thought, what I can do is this. I can take a couple of pieces, Ed'll never care, and box them up and send them to Juliana, so she'll see what I'm doing. The postal authorities will trace her. I'll send it registered to her last known address. What'll she say when she opens the box? There'll have to be a note from me explaining that I made it myself, that I'm a partner in a little new creative jewelry business. I'll fire her imagination, give her an account that'll make her want to know more, that'll get her interested. I'll talk about the gems and the metals, the places we're selling to, the fancy stores.
Isn't it along here?
Ed said, slowing the truck. They were in heavy downtown traffic. Buildings blotted out the sky.
I better park.
Another 5 blocks, Frink said.
Got one of those marijuana cigarettes? Ed said.
One would calm me right about now. Frink passed him his package of Tien Lai's, the heavenly music brand he had learned to smoke at WM Corporation.
I know she's living with some guy, Frink said to himself, sleeping with him, as if she was his wife. I know Juliana. She couldn't survive any other way. I know how she gets around nightfall, when it gets cold and dark and everybody's home sitting around the living room. She was never made for a solitary life.
Me neither, he realized.
Maybe the guy's a real nice guy,
some shy student she picked up. She'd be a good woman for some young guy who had never had the courage to approach a woman before. She's not hard or cynical. It would do him a lot of good. I hope to hell she's not with some older guy. That's what I couldn't stand. Some experienced, mean guy with a toothpick sticking out of the side of his mouth, pushing her around. He felt himself begin to breathe heavily. Image of some beefy, hairy guy stepping down hard on Juliana, making her life miserable. I know she'd finally wind up killing herself, he thought. It's in the cards for her if she doesn't find the right man. And that means a really gentle, sensitive, kindly student type who would be able to appreciate all those thoughts she has. I was too rough for her, he thought. And I'm not so bad. There are a hell of a lot of guys worse than me. I could pretty well figure out what she was thinking, what she wanted, when she felt lonely or bad or depressed. I spent a lot of time worrying and fussing over her, but it wasn't enough. She deserved more. She deserves a lot, he thought. I'm parking, Ed said. He had found a place and was backing the truck, peering over his shoulder. Listen, Frink said, can I send a couple of pieces to my wife? I didn't know you were married. Intent on parking, Ed answered him reflexively. Sure, as long as they're not silver. Ed shut off the truck motor. We're here, he said. He puffed marijuana smoke, then stubbed the cigarette out on the dashboard, dropped the remains to the cab floor. Wish me luck. Luck, Frank Frink said. Hey, look, there's one of those Jap waka poems on the back of this cigarette package. Ed read the poem aloud, over the traffic noises. Hearing a cuckoo cry, I looked up in the direction whence the sound came. What did I see? Only the pale moon and the dawning sky. He handed the package of Tien Lai's back to Frink. Ki reist, he said, then slapped Frink on the back, grinned, opened the truck door, picked up the wicker hamper, and stepped from the truck. I'll let you put the dime in the meter, he said, starting off down the sidewalk. In an instant, he had disappeared among the other pedestrians. Juliana, Frink thought. Are you as alone as I am? He got out of the truck and put a dime in the parking meter. Fear, he thought. This whole jewelry venture. What if it should fail? What if it should fail? That was how the oracle put it, wailing tears, beating the pot. Man faces the darkening shadows of his life, his passage to the grave. If she were here, it would not be so bad. Not bad at all. I'm scared, he realized. Suppose Ed doesn't sell a thing. Suppose they laugh at us. What then? On a sheet on the floor of the front room of her apartment, Juliana lay holding Joe Cinadella against her. The room was warm and stuffy with mid-afternoon sunlight. Her body and the body of the man in her arms were damp with perspiration. A drop, rolling down Joe's forehead, clung a moment to his cheekbone, then fell to her throat. You're still dripping, she murmured. He said nothing, his breathing long, slow, regular, like the ocean, she thought. We are nothing but water inside.
How was it?
She asked. He mumbled that it had been okay. I thought so, Juliana thought. I can tell. Now we both have to get up, pull ourselves together. Or is that bad? Sign of subconscious disapproval. He stirred.
Are you getting up?
She gripped him tight with both her arms.
Don't. Not yet.
Don't you have to get to the gym?
I'm not going to the gym, Juliana said to herself. Don't you know that? We will go somewhere. We won't stay here too much longer, but it will be a place we haven't been before. It's time.
She felt him start to draw himself backward and up onto his knees, felt her hands slide along his damp, slippery back. Then she could hear him walking away, his bare feet against the floor. To the bathroom, no doubt, for his shower. It's over, she thought. Oh, well, she sighed.
I hear you, Joe said from the bathroom. Groaning. Always downcast, aren't you? Worry, fear, and suspicion about me and everything else in the world.
He emerged briefly, dripping with soapy water, face beaming.
How would you like to take a trip?
Her pulse quickened.
Where?
To some big city. How about north, to Denver? I'll take you out, buy you ticket to a show, a good restaurant, taxi, get you evening dress, or what you need. Okay?
She could hardly believe him, but she wanted to. She tried to.
Will that distude of yours make it?
Joe called.
Sure,
she said.
We'll both get some nice clothes, he said. Enjoy ourselves, maybe for the first time in our lives, Keep you from cracking up.
Where'll we get the money?
Joe said.
I have it. Look in my suitcase.
He shut the bathroom door. The racket of water shut out any further words. Opening the dresser, she got out his dented, stained little grip. Sure enough, in one corner she found an envelope. It contained Reich Bank bills, high value and good anywhere. Then we can go, she realized. Maybe he's not just stringing me along. I just wish I could get inside him and see what's there, she thought as she counted the money. Beneath the envelope she found a huge, cylindrical fountain pen. Or at least it appeared to be that. It had a clip, anyhow. But it weighed so much. Gingerly she lifted it out, unscrewed the cap. Yes, it had a gold point, but...
What is this?
She asked Joe, when he reappeared from the shower. He took it from her, returned it to the grip. How carefully he handled it. She noticed that, reflected on it, perplexed.
More morbidity?
Joe said. He seemed light-hearted, more so than at any time since she had met him. With a yell of enthusiasm, he clasped her around the waist, then hoisted her up into his arms, rocking her, swinging her back and forth, peering down into her face, breathing his warm breath over her, squeezing her until she bleated.
No, she said. I'm just slow to change.
Still a little scared of you, she thought. So scared I can't even say it, tell you about it.
Out the window,
Joe cried, stalking across the room with her in his arms.
Here we go.
Please,
she said.
Kidding. Listen, we're going on a march, like the March on Rome. You remember that? The Duce led them, my Uncle Carlo, for example. Now we have a little march, less important, not noted in the history books, right?
Inclining his head, he kissed her on the mouth so hard that their teeth clashed.
How nice we both look, in our new clothes. And you can explain to me exactly how to talk, deport myself, right? Teach me manners, right?
You talk okay,
Juliana said. Better than me, even.
No.
He became abruptly somber.
I talk very bad. A real wop accent. Didn't you notice it when you first met me in the cafe?
I guess so,
she said. It did not seem important to her.
Only a woman knows the social conventions,
Joe said, carrying her back and dropping her to bounce frighteningly on the bed.
Without the woman, we discuss racing cars and horses and tell dirty jokes. No civilization.
You're in a strange mood, Juliana thought. Restless and brooding until you decide to move on. Then you become hopped up. Do you really want me? You can ditch me, leave me here. It's happened before. I would ditch you, she thought, if I were going on.
Is that your pay?
She asked as he dressed.
You saved it up?
It was so much. Of course, there was a good deal of money in the East.
All the other truck drivers I've talked to never made so...
You say I'm a truck driver? Joe broke in. Listen, I rode that rig not to drive, but to keep off hijackers. Looked like a truck driver, snoozing in the cab.
Flopping in a chair in the corner of the room, he lay back, pretending sleep, his mouth open, body limp.
See?
At first, she did not see. And then she realized that in his hand was a knife, as thin as a kitchen potato skewer. Good grief, she thought. Where had it come from? Out of his sleeve, out of the air itself.
That's why the Volkswagen people hired me. Service record. We protected ourselves against Hasselden, those commandos. He led them.
His black eyes glinted. He grinned sideways at Juliana.
Guess who got the colonel there at the end, when we caught them on the Nile, him and four of his long-range desert group, months after the Cairo campaign. They raided us for gasoline one night. I was on sentry duty. Hasselden sneaked up, rubbed with black all over his face and body, even his hands. They had no wire that time, only grenades and submachine guns. All too noisy. He tried to break my larynx. I got him.
From the chair, Joe sprang up at her, laughing.
Let's pack. You tell them at the gym you're taking a few days off. Phone them.
His account simply did not convince her. Perhaps he had not been in North Africa at all, had not even fought in the war on the Axis side, had not even fought.
What hijackers? She wondered. No truck that she knew of had come through Cannon City from the East Coast with an armed professional ex-soldier as guard. Maybe he had not lived in the USA, had made everything up from the start. A line to snare her, to get her interested, to appear romantic. Maybe he's insane, she thought. Ironic. I may actually do what I pretended many times to have done, use my judo in self-defense. To save my virginity? My life, she thought. But more likely, he is just some poor, low-class wop laboring slob with delusions of glory. He wants to go on a grand spree, spend all his money, live it up, and then go back to his monotonous existence. And he needs a girl to do it.
Okay, she said. I'll call the gym.
As she went toward the hall, she thought, he'll buy me expensive clothes and then take me to some luxurious hotel. Every man yearns to have a really well-dressed woman before he dies, even if he has to buy her the clothes himself. This binge is probably Joe Cinadella's lifelong ambition. And he is shrewd. I'll bet he's right in his analysis of me. I have an erotic fear of the masculine. Frank knew it, too. That's why he and I broke up. That's why I still feel this anxiety now, this mistrust. When she returned from the payphone, she found Joe once more engrossed in the grasshopper, scowling as he read, unaware of everything else.
"Weren't you going to let me read that?"
she asked.
"Maybe while I drive," Joe said, without looking up. "You're going to drive, but it's my car."
He said nothing. He merely went on reading. At the cash register, Robert Sheldon looked up to see a lean, tall, dark-haired man entering the store. The man wore a slightly less than fashionable suit and carried a large wicker hamper. Salesman. Yet he did not have the cheerful smile. Instead, he had a grim, morose look on his leathery face, more like a plumber or an electrician, Robert Sheldon thought. When he had finished with his customer, Sheldon called to the man,
"Who do you represent?"
"Ed Frank Jewelry," the man mumbled back. He had set his hamper down on one of the counters.
"Never heard of them."
Sheldon sauntered over as the man unfastened the top of the hamper and with much wasted motion opened it.
"Hand-wrought. Each unique. Each an original. Brass, copper, silver. Even hot-forged black iron."
Sheldon glanced into the hamper. Metal on black velvet. Peculiar.
"No thanks. Not in my line."
"This represents American artistry. Contemporary."
Shaking his head no, Sheldon walked back to the cash register. For a time, the man stood fooling with his velvet display boards and hamper. He was neither taking the boards out nor putting them back. He seemed to have no idea what he was doing. His arms folded, Sheldon watched, thinking about various problems of the day. At 2, he had an appointment to show some early period cups. Then at 3, another batch of items returning from the Cal Labs, home from their authenticity test. He had been having more and more pieces examined in the last couple of weeks, ever since the nasty incident with the Colt 44. "These are not plated," the man with the wicker hamper said, holding up a cuff bracelet.
"Solid copper."
Sheldon nodded without answering. The man would hang around for a while, shuffle his samples about, but finally he would move on. The telephone rang. Sheldon answered it. Customer inquiring about an ancient rocking chair, very valuable, which Sheldon was having mended for him. It had not been finished, and Sheldon had to tell a convincing story. Staring through the store window at the midday traffic, he soothed and reassured. At last the customer, somewhat appeased, rang off. No doubt about it, he thought as he hung up the phone. The Colt 44 affair had shaken him considerably. He no longer viewed his stock with the same reverence. Bit of knowledge like that goes a long way. Akin to primal childhood awakening, facts of life. Shows, he ruminated, the link with our early years. Not merely U.S. history involved, but our own personal. As if, he thought, question might arise as to authenticity of our birth certificate, or our impression of Dad. Maybe I don't actually recall FDR as example. Synthetic image distilled from hearing assorted talk. Myth implanted subtly in tissue of brain. Like, he thought, myth of Heppelwhite, myth of Chippendale, or rather more on lines of Abraham Lincoln ate here. Used this old silver knife, fork, spoon. You can't see it, but the fact remains. At the other counter, still fumbling with his displays and wicker hamper, the salesman said,
"We can make pieces to order, custom-made, if any of your customers have their own ideas."
His voice had a strangled quality. He cleared his throat, gazing at Childen, and then down at a piece of jewelry which he held. He did not know how to leave, evidently. Childen smiled and said nothing. Not my responsibility, his to get himself back out of here, place saved or no. Tough, such discomfort. But he doesn't have to be a salesman. We all suffer in this life. Look at me, taking it all day from Japs such as Mr. Tagomi. By merest inflection, managed to rub my nose in it, make my life miserable. And then, an idea occurred to him. Fellow's obviously not experienced. Look at him. Maybe I can get some stuff on consignment. Worth a try.
Hey,
Shulden said. The man glanced up swiftly, fastened his gaze. Advancing toward him, his arm still folded, Childen said,
"Looks like a quiet half hour here. No promises, but you can lay some of those things out. Clear back those racks of ties."
He pointed. Nodding, the man began to clear himself a space on the top of the counter. He reopened his hamper, once more fumbled with the velvet trays. He'll lay everything out, Childen knew. Arrange it painstakingly for the next hour. Fuss and adjust until he's got it all set up. Hoping, praying, watching me out of the corner of his eye every second, to see if I'm taking any interest, any at all.
When you have it out, Childen said, if I'm not too busy, I'll take a look.
The man worked feverishly, as if he had been stung. Several customers entered the store then, and Childen greeted them. He turned his attention to them and their wishes, and forgot the salesman laboring over his display. The salesman, recognizing the situation, became stealthy in his movements. He made himself inconspicuous. Childen sold a shaving mug, almost sold a hand-hooked rug, took a deposit on an Afghan. Time passed. At last the customers left. Once more the store was empty except for himself and the salesman. The salesman had finished. His entire selection of jewelry lay arranged on the black velvet on the surface of the counter. Going leisurely over, Robert Shulton lit a Lando Smiles and stood rocking back and forth on his heels, humming beneath his breath. The salesman stood silently. Neither spoke. At last, Shulton reached out and pointed at a pin.
"I like that."
The salesman said in a rapid voice,
"That's a good one. You won't find any wire brush scratches. All rouge finished, and it won't tarnish. We have a plastic lacquer sprayed on them that'll last for years. It's the best industrial lacquer available."
Childen nodded slightly.
"What we've done here," the salesman said, "is to adapt tried and proven industrial techniques to jewelry making. As far as I know, nobody has ever done it before. No molds, all metal to metal, welding and brazing." He paused. "The backs are hand-soldered."
Childen picked up two bracelets, then a pin, then another pin. He held them for a moment, then set them off to one side. The salesman's face twitched. Hope. Examining the price tag on a necklace, Childen said,
"Is this
retail? Your price is 50% of that. And if you buy, say, around $100 or so, we'll give you an additional 2%.
One by one, Childen laid several pieces aside. With each additional one, the salesman became more agitated. He talked faster and faster, finally repeating himself, even saying meaningless, foolish things, all in an undertone and very urgently. He really thinks he's going to sell, Childen knew. By his own expression, he showed nothing. He went on with the game of picking pieces.
"That's an especially good one," the salesman said, rambling on, as Childen fished out a large pendant and then ceased. "I think you got our best, all our best," the man laughed. "You really have good taste."
His eyes darted. He was adding in his mind what Childen had chosen, the total of the sale. Childen said,
"Our policy with untried merchandise has to be consignment."
For a few seconds the salesman did not understand. He stopped his talking, but he stared without comprehension. Childen smiled at him.
"Consignment?" the salesman echoed at last. "Will you prefer not to leave it?"
Childen said. Stammering, the man finally said,
"You mean I leave it and you pay me later on when..."
"You get 2/3 of the proceeds, when the pieces sell. That way you make much more. You have to wait, of course, but..."
Childen shrugged.
"It's up to you. I can give it some window display, possibly. And if it moves, then possibly later on, in a month or so, with the next order, well, we might see our way clear to buy some outright.
The salesman had now spent well over an hour showing his wares, Children realized, and he had everything out, all his displays disarranged and dismantled, another hour's work to get it back ready to take somewhere else. There was silence. Neither man spoke.
"Those pieces you put to one side,"
the salesman said in a low voice,
"they're the ones you want?"
"Yes. I'll let you leave them all."
Children strolled over to his office in the rear of the store.
"I'll write up a tag, so you'll have a record of what you've left with me."
As he came back with his tag book, he added,
"You understand that when merchandise is left on a consignment basis, the store doesn't assume liability in case of theft or damage."
He had a little mimeograph release for the salesman to sign. The store would never have to account for the items left. When the unsold portion was returned, if some could not be located, they must have been stolen, Children declared to himself. There's always theft going on in stores, especially small items like jewelry. There was no way that Robert Children could lose. He did not have to pay for this man's jewelry. He had no investment in this kind of inventory. If any of it sold, he made a profit, and if it did not, he simply returned it all, or as much as could be found, to the salesman at some vague later date. Children made out the tag, listing the items. He signed it and gave a copy to the salesman.
"You can give me a call," he said, "in a month or so, to find out how it's been doing."
Taking the jewelry which he wanted, he went off to the back of the store, leaving the salesman to gather up his remaining stuff. "I didn't think he'd go along with it," he thought. "You never know. That's why it's always worth trying." When he next looked up, he saw that the salesman was ready to leave. He had his wicker hamper under his arm, and the counter was clear. The salesman was coming toward him, holding something out.
"Yes?"
Children said. He had been going over some correspondence.
"I want to leave our card."
The salesman put down an odd-looking little square of gray and red paper on Children's desk.
"Ed Frank Custom Jewelry. It has our address and phone number, in case you want to get in touch with us."
Children nodded, smiled silently, and returned to his work. When next he paused and looked up, the store was empty. The salesman had gone. Putting a nickel into the wall dispenser, Children obtained a cup of hot instant tea, which he sipped contemplatively.
"I wonder if it will sell," he wondered.
"Very unlikely. But it is well made, and one never sees anything like it." He examined one of the pins. Quite striking design. Certainly not amateurs. "I'll change the tags, mark them up a lot higher, push the handmade angle, and the uniqueness, custom originals, small sculptures, wear a work of art, exclusive creation on your lapel or wrist." And there was another notion circulating and growing in the back of Robert Children's mind. With these, there's no problem of authenticity, and that problem may someday wreck the historic American artifacts industry, not today or tomorrow, but after that, who knows? Better not to have all irons in one fire. That visit by that Jewish crook, that might be the harbinger. If I quietly build up a stock of non-historic objects, contemporary work with no historicity, either real or imagined, I might find I have the edge over the competition. And as long as it isn't costing me anything... Leaning back his chair so that it rested against the wall, he sipped his tea and pondered. The moment changes. One must be ready to change with it, or otherwise left high and dry. Adapt. The rule of survival, he thought. Keep eye peeled regarding situation around you. Learn its demands, and meet them. Be there at the right time, doing the right thing. Be Yinnish. The Oriental knows. The smart black Yinnish eyes. Suddenly he had a good idea. It made him sit upright instantly. Two birds, one stone. Ah! He hopped to his feet, excited. Carefully wrapped best of jewelry pieces, removing tag, of course, pin, pendant, or bracelet. Something nice, anyhow. Then, since have to leave shop, close up at 2 as it is. Saunter over to Kasura's apartment building. Mr. Kasura, Paul, will be at work. However, Mrs. Kasura, Betty, will very likely be home. Graft gift, this new original U.S. artwork. Compliments of myself personally, in order to obtain high place reaction. This is how a new line is introduced. Isn't it lovely? Whole selection back at store, drop in, etc. This one for you, Betty. He trembled. Just she and I, midday in the apartment. Husband off at work. All on up and up, however. Brilliant pretext. Airtight. Getting a small box plus wrapping paper and ribbon, Robert Sheldon began preparing a gift for Mrs. Kasura. Dark, attractive woman, slender in her silk oriental dress, high heels, and so on. Or maybe today, blue cotton coolie-style lounging pajamas, very light and comfortable and informal. Ah, he thought. Or is this too bold? Husband Paul becoming irked, scenting out and reacting badly. Perhaps go slower. Take gift to him. To his office? Give much the same story, but to him. Then let him give gift to her. No suspicion. And, Robert Sheldon thought, then I give Betty a call on the phone tomorrow or next day to get her reaction. Even more airtight. When Frank Frink saw his business partner coming back up the sidewalk, he could tell that it had not gone well. What happened? He said, taking the wicker hamper from Ed and putting it in the truck. Jesus Christ, you were gone an hour and a half. It took him that long to say no? Ed said, he didn't say no. He looked tired. He got into the truck and sat. What did he say, then? Opening the hamper, Frink saw that a good many of the pieces were gone, many of their best. He took a lot. What's the matter, then?
Consignment, Ed said.
You let him?
He could not believe it.
We talked it over.
I don't know how come.
Christ, Frink said. I'm sorry. He acted like he was going to buy it. He picked a lot out. I thought he was buying.
They sat together silently in the truck for a long time. Chapter 10. It had been a terrible 2 weeks for Mr. Baines. From his hotel room, he had called the trade mission every day at noon to ask if the old gentleman had put in an appearance. The answer had been an unvarying no. Mr. Tacomi's voice had become colder and more formal each day. As Mr. Baines prepared to make his 16th call, he thought, sooner or later they'll tell me that Mr. Tacomi is out, that he isn't accepting any more calls from me. And that will be that. What has happened? Where is Mr. Yatabi? He had a fairly good idea. The death of Martin Borman had caused immediate consternation in Tokyo. Mr. Yatabi no doubt had been en route to San Francisco, a day or so offshore, when new instructions had reached him. Returned to the home islands for further consultation. Bad luck, Mr. Baines realized. Possibly even fatal. But he had to remain where he was, in San Francisco, still trying to arrange the meeting for which he had come. 45 minutes by Lufthansa rocket from Berlin, and now this. A weird time in which we are alive. We can travel anywhere we want, even to other planets. And for what? To sit day after day, declining in morale and hope, falling into an interminable ennui. And meanwhile, the others are busy. They are not sitting helplessly waiting. Mr. Baines unfolded the midday edition of the Nippon Times and once more read the headlines. Dr. Goebbels named Reichs-Chancellor. Surprise solution to leadership problem by Partei Committee. Radio speech viewed decisive. Berlin crowds cheer. Statement expected. Göring may be named police chief over Heydrich. He reread the entire article, and then he put the paper once more away, took the phone, and gave the trade mission number. This is Mr. Baines. May I have Mr. Tagomi?
A moment, sir.
A very long moment.
Mr. Tagomi here.
Mr. Baines took a deep breath and said,
forgive this situation, depressing to us both, sir.
Ah, Mr. Baines.
Your hospitality to me, sir, could not be exceeded. Some day I know you will have understanding of the reasons which cause me to defer our conference until the old gentleman, regretfully, he has not arrived.
Mr. Baines shut his eyes.
I thought maybe since yesterday.
Afraid not, sir.
The barest politeness.
If you will excuse me, Mr. Baines, pressing business.
Good day, sir.
The phone clicked. Today Mr. Tagomi had rung off without even saying goodbye. Mr. Baines slowly hung the receiver.
I must take action. Can wait no longer.
It had been made very clear to him by his superiors that he was not to contact the Abwehr under any circumstances. He was simply to wait until he had managed to make connections with the Japanese military representative. He was to confer with the Japanese, and then he was to return to Berlin. But no one had foreseen that Borman would die at this particular moment. Therefore, the orders had to be superseded. by more practical advice, his own in this case, since there was no one else to consult. In the PSA, at least 10 of their persons were at work, but some of them, and possibly all, were known to the local SD and its competent senior regional chief, Bruno Kreutz von Meer. Years ago, he had met Bruno briefly at a party gathering. The man had had a certain infamous prestige in police circles, inasmuch as it had been he, in 1943, who had uncovered the British Czech plot on Reinhard Heydrich's life, and therefore who might be said to have saved the hangman from assassination. In any case, Bruno Kreutz von Meer was already then ascending in authority within the SD. He was not a mere police bureaucrat. He was, in fact, a rather dangerous man. There was even a possibility that even with all the precautions taken, both on the part of the Abwehr in Berlin and the Tokuka in Tokyo, the SD had learned of this attempted meeting in San Francisco in the offices of the ranking trade mission. However, this was, after all, Japanese-administered land. The SD had no official authority to interfere. It could see to it that the German principal, himself in this case, was arrested as soon as he set foot again on Reich territory, but it could hardly take action against the Japanese principal or against the existence of the meeting itself. At least, so he hoped. Was there any possibility that the SD had managed to detain the old Japanese gentleman somewhere along the route? It was a long way from Tokyo to San Francisco, especially for a person so elderly and frail that he could not attempt air travel. What I must do, Mr. Baines knew, is find out from those above me whether Mr. Yutabi is still coming. They would know. If the SD had intercepted him, or if the Tokyo government had recalled him, they would know that. And if they have managed to get to the old gentleman, he realized, they certainly are going to get to me. Yet the situation, even in those circumstances, was not hopeless. An idea had come to Mr. Baines as he waited day after day alone in his room at the Aberati Hotel. It would be better to give my information to Mr. Tagomi than to return to Berlin empty-handed. At least that way there would be a chance, even if it is rather slight, that ultimately the proper people will be informed. But Mr. Tagomi could only listen. That was the fault in his idea. At best, he could hear, commit to memory, and as soon as possible take a business trip back to the home islands. Whereas Mr. Yutabi stood at policy level. He could both hear and speak. Still, it was better than nothing. The time was growing too short. To begin all over, to arrange painstakingly, cautiously, over a period of months, once again, the delicate contact between a faction in Germany and a faction in Japan. It certainly would surprise Mr. Tagomi, he thought acidly, to suddenly find knowledge of that kind resting on his shoulders, a long way from facts about injection molds. Possibly he might have a nervous breakdown, either blurt out the information to someone around him, or withdraw, pretend even to himself that he had not heard it, simply refuse to believe me, rise to his feet, bow and excuse himself from the room the moment I begin. Indiscreet, he could regard it that way. He is not supposed to hear such matters. So easy, Mr. Baines thought. The way out is so immediate, so available to him. He thought, I wish it was for me. And yet, in the final analysis, it is not possible even for Mr. Tagomi. We are no different. He can close his ears to the news as it comes from me, comes in the form of words. But later, when it is not a matter of words, if I can make that clear to him now, or to whomever I finally speak. Leaving his hotel room, Mr. Baines descended by elevator to the lobby. Outside on the sidewalk, he had the doorman call a pedicab for him, and soon he was on his way up Market Street, the Chinese driver pumping away energetically. There, he said to the driver, when he made out the sign which he was watching for. Pull over to the curb. The pedicab stopped by a fire hydrant. Mr. Baines paid the driver and sent him off. No one seemed to have followed. Mr. Baines set off along the sidewalk on foot. A moment later, along with several other shoppers, he entered the big downtown Fuga department store. There were shoppers everywhere, counter after counter, salesgirls, mostly white, with a sprinkling of Japanese as department managers. The din was terrific. After some confusion, Mr. Baines located the men's clothing department. He stopped at the racks of men's trousers and began to inspect them. Presently a clerk, a young white, came over, greeting him. Mr. Baines said, I have returned for the pair of dark brown wool slacks which I was looking at yesterday.
Meeting the clerk's gaze, he said, "You're not the man I spoke to. He was taller, red mustache, rather thin. On his jacket he had the name Larry." The clerk said, "He is presently out to lunch, but will return." "I'll go into a dressing room and try these on," Mr. Baines said, taking a pair of slacks from the rack. "Certainly, sir." The clerk indicated a vacant dressing room and then went off to wait on someone else. Mr. Baines entered the dressing room and shut the door. He seated himself on one of the two chairs and waited. After a few minutes, there was a knock. The door of the dressing room opened, and a short, middle-aged Japanese entered. "You are from out of state, sir," he said to Mr. Baines. "And I am to okay your credit? Let me see your identification." He shut the door behind him. Mr. Baines got out his wallet. The Japanese seated himself with the wallet and began inspecting the contents. He halted at a photo of a girl.
"Very pretty."
"My daughter, Martha."
"I, too, have a daughter named Martha," the Japanese said. "She at present is in Chicago studying piano."
"My daughter," Mr. Baines said, "is about to be married." The Japanese returned the wallet and waited expectantly. Mr. Baines said, "I have been here 2 weeks and Mr. Yatabi has not shown up. I want to find out if he is still coming, and if not, what I should do."
"Return tomorrow afternoon,"
the Japanese said. He rose, and Mr. Baines also rose.
"Good day."
"Good day," Mr. Baines said. He left the dressing room, hung the pair of slacks back up on the rack, and left the Fuga department store. That did not take very long, he thought, as he moved along the busy downtown sidewalk with the other pedestrians. Can he actually get the information by then? Contact Berlin, relay my questions, do all the coding and decoding, every step involved? Apparently so. Now I wish I had approached the agent sooner. I would have saved myself such worry and distress. And evidently no major risk was involved. It had all appeared to go off smoothly. It took, in fact, only 5 or 6 minutes. Mr. Baines wandered on, looking into store windows. He felt much better now. Presently he found himself viewing display photos of honky-tonk cabarets, grimy, fly-specked, utterly white nudes, whose breasts hung like half-inflated volleyballs. That sight amused him, and he loitered, people pushing past him on their various errands up and down Market Street. At least he had done something, at last. What a relief! Propped comfortably against the car door, Juliana read. Beside her, his elbow out the window, Joe drove with one hand lightly on the wheel, a cigarette stuck to his lower lip. He was a good driver, and they had covered a good deal of the distance from Cannon City already. The car radio played mushy beer garden folk music, an accordion band doing one of the countless polkas or schottisches. She had never been able to tell them one from another. "Kitsch," Joe said when the music ended.
"Listen, I know a lot about music. I'll tell you who a great conductor was. You probably don't remember him. Arturo Toscanini."
"No," she said, still reading.
"He was Italian, but the Nazis wouldn't let him conduct after the war because of his politics. He's dead now. I don't like that Von Karajan, permanent conductor of the New York Philharmonic. We had to go to concerts by him, our work dorm. What I like, being a WOP, you can guess."
He glanced at her.
"You like that book?" he said. "It's engrossing." "I like Verdi and Puccini. All we get in New York is a heavy German bombastic Wagner and Orff, and we have to go every week to one of those corny U.S. Nazi Party dramatic spectacles at the Madison Square Garden, with the flags and the drums and trumpets and the flickering flame. History of the Gothic Tribes, or other educational crap, chanted instead of spoken, so as to be called art. Did you ever see New York before the war?"
"Yes," she said, trying to read.
"Didn't they have swell theater in those days?" "That's what I heard. Now it's the same as the movie industry. It's all a cartel in Berlin. In the 13 years I've been in New York, not one good musical or play ever opened. Only those..."
"Let me read,"
Juliana said.
"And the same with the book business," Joe said, unperturbed. "It's all a cartel operating out of Munich. All they do in New York is print, just big printing presses. But before the war, New York was the center of the world's publishing industry, or so they say."
Putting her fingers in her ears, she concentrated on the page open in her lap, shutting his voice out. She had arrived at a section in The Grasshopper which described the fabulous television, and it enthralled her, especially the part about the inexpensive little sets for backward people in Africa and Asia. Only Yankee know-how and the mass production system, Detroit, Chicago, Cleveland, the magic names, could have done the trick, sent that ceaseless and almost witlessly noble flood of cheap $1, the China dollar, the trade dollar, television kits to every village and backwater of the Orient. And when the kit had been assembled by some gaunt, feverish-minded youth in the village, starved for a chance, for that which the generous Americans held out to him, that tinny little instrument with its built-in power supply, no larger than a marble, began to receive. And what did it receive? Crouching before the screen, the youths of the village, and often the elders as well, saw words, instructions, how to read first, then the rest, how to dig a deeper well, plow a deeper furrow, how to purify their water, heal their sick. Overhead, the American artificial moon wheeled, distributing the signal, carrying it everywhere, to all the waiting, avid masses of the East. "Are you reading straight through?" Joe asked. "Or skipping around in it?" She said, "This is wonderful. He has us sending food and education to all the Asiatics, millions of them."
"Welfare work on a worldwide scale," Joe said.
"Yes, the New Deal under Tugwell. They raised the level of the masses. Listen," she read aloud to Joe. What had China been? Yearning, one needful, commingled entity looking toward the West, its great democratic president, Chiang Kai-shek, who had led the Chinese people through the years of war, now into the years of peace, on to the decade of rebuilding. But for China, it was not rebuilding, for that almost supernaturally vast flat land had never been built, lay still slumbering in the ancient dream. Arousing. Yes, the entity, the giant, had to partake at last of full consciousness, had to waken into the modern world with its jet airplanes and atomic power, its autobahns and factories and medicines. And from whence would come the crack of thunder which would rouse the giant? Chiang had known that, even during the struggle to defeat Japan. It would come from the United States. And by 1950, American technicians and engineers, teachers, doctors, agronomists, swarming like some new life form into each province, each... Interrupting, Joe said,
"You know what he's done, don't you? He's taken the best about Nazism, the socialist part, the Tat organization, and the economic advances we got through Speer. And who's he giving the credit to? The New Deal. And he's left out the bad part, the SS part, the racial extermination and segregation. It's a utopia. You imagine if the Allies had won, the New Deal would have been able to revive the economy and make those socialist welfare improvements like he says? Hell no. He's talking about the form of state syndicalism, the corporate estate, like we developed under the Duce. He's saying, you would have had all the good and none of...
Let me read, she said fiercely. He shrugged, but he did cease babbling. She read on at once, but to herself. And these markets, the countless millions of China, set the factories in Detroit and Chicago to humming. That vast mouth could never be filled. Those people could not in 100 years be given enough trucks or bricks or steel ingots or clothing or typewriters or canned peas or clocks or radios or nose drops. The American workman, by 1960, had the highest standard of living in the world, and all due to what they genteelly called the Most Favored Nation clause in every commercial transaction with the East. The U.S. no longer occupied Japan, and she had never occupied China. And yet the fact could not be disputed. Canton and Tokyo and Shanghai did not buy from the British. They bought American. And with each sale, the working man in Baltimore or Los Angeles or Atlanta saw a little more prosperity. It seemed to the planners, the men of vision in the White House, that they had almost achieved their goal. The exploring rocket ships would soon nose cautiously out into the void, from a world that had at last seen an end to its age-old griefs, hunger, plague, war, ignorance. In the British Empire, equal measures toward social and economic progress had brought similar relief to the masses in India, Burma, Africa, the Middle East. The factories of the Ruhr, Manchester, of the Saar, the oil of Baku, all flowed and interacted to intricate but effective harmony. The populations of Europe basked in what appeared... I think they should be the rulers, Juliana said, pausing. They always were the best, the British.
Jo said nothing to that, although she waited. At last she went on reading. Realization of Napoleon's vision, rational homogeneity of the diverse ethnic strains which had squabbled and balkanized Europe since the collapse of Rome, vision two of Charlemagne, united Christendom, totally at peace, not only with itself, but with the balance of the world. And yet, there still remained one annoying sore. Singapore. The Malay states held a large Chinese population, mostly of the enterprising business class, and these thrifty, industrious bourgeois saw in American administration of China a more equitable treatment of what was called the native. Under British rule, the darker races were excluded from the country clubs, the hotels, the better restaurants. They found themselves, as in archaic times, confined to particular sections of the train and bus and, perhaps worst of all, limited to their choice of residence within each city. These natives discerned, and noted in their table conversations and newspapers, that in the USA the color problem had by 1950 been solved. Whites and Negroes lived and worked and ate shoulder by shoulder, even in the Deep South. World War II had ended discrimination.
"Is there trouble?"
Juliana asked Joe. He grunted, keeping his eyes on the road.
"Tell me what happens," she said. "I know I won't get to finish it. We'll be in Denver pretty soon. Do America and Britain get into a war, and one emerges as ruler of the world?"
Presently, Joe said, "In some ways, it's not a bad book. He works all the details out. The U.S. has the Pacific, about like our East Asia co-prosperity sphere. They divide Russia. It works for around 10 years. Then there's trouble, naturally."
"Why naturally?"
"Human nature," Joe added. "Nature of states, suspicion, fear, greed. Churchill thinks the USA is undermining British rule in South Asia by appealing to the large Chinese populations, who naturally are pro-USA, due to Chiang Kai-shek. The British start setting up," he grinned at her briefly, "what are called detention preserves, concentration camps, in other words, for thousands of maybe disloyal Chinese. They're accused of sabotage and propaganda. Churchill is so..."
"You mean he's still in power? Wouldn't he be around 90?
Joe said, "That's where the British system has it over the American. Every 8 years, the U.S. boots out its leaders, no matter how qualified. But Churchill just stays on. The U.S. doesn't have any leadership like him, after Tugwell. Just non-entities. And the older he gets, the more autocratic and rigid he gets. Churchill, I mean. Until, by 1960, he's like some old warlord out of Central Asia. Nobody can cross him. He's been in power 20 years.
"Good God," she said, leaping through the last part of the book, searching for verification of what Joe was saying.
"On that, I agree," Joe said. "Churchill was the one good leader the British had during the war. If they'd retained him, they'd have been better off. I tell you, a state is no better than its leader. Führerprinzip, principle of leadership, like the Nazis say. They're right. Even this Abinson has to face that. Sure, the USA expands economically after winning the war over Japan, because it's got that huge market in Asia that it's wrested from the Japs. But that's not enough. That's got no spirituality. Not that the British have. They're both plutocracies, ruled by the rich. If they had won, all they'd have thought about was making more money, the upper class. Abinson, he's wrong. There would be no social reform, no welfare public works plans. The Anglo-Saxon plutocrats wouldn't have permitted it." Juliana thought, spoken like a devout fascist. Evidently, Joe perceived by her expression what she was thinking. He turned toward her, slowing the car, one eye on her, one on the cars ahead.
"Listen, I'm not an intellectual. Fascism has no need of that. What is wanted is the deed. Theory derives from action. What our corporate state demands from us is comprehension of the social forces, of history. You see? I tell you, I know, Juliana."
His tone was earnest, almost beseeching.
"Those old rotten money-run empires, Britain and France and USA, although the latter actually a sort of bastard sideshoot, not strictly empire, but money-oriented even so, they had no soul, so naturally no future, no growth. Nazis, a bunch of street thugs, I agree. You agree, right?"
She had to smile,
His Italian mannerisms had overpowered him in his attempt to drive and make his speech simultaneously.
Abinson talks like it's a big issue as to whether U.S. or Britain ultimately wins out. Bull! Has no merit, no history to it. Six of one, a dozen of other. You ever read what the Duce wrote? Inspired. Beautiful man. Beautiful writing. Explains the underlying actuality of every event. Real issue in war was old versus new. Money. That's why Nazis dragged Jewish question mistakenly into it. Versus communal mass spirit, what Nazis called Gemeinschaft, folkness, like Soviet. Commune, right? Only communists sneaked in Pan-Slavic Peter the Great Empire ambitions along with it, made social reform means for imperial ambitions.
Giuliana thought, like Mussolini did. Exactly.
Nazi thuggery, a tragedy.
Joe stuttered away as he passed a slow-moving truck.
But change is always harsh on the loser. Nothing new. Look at previous revolutions such as French or Cromwell against Irish. Too much philosophy and Germanic temperament. Too much theater, too. All those rallies. You never find true fascists talking, only doing. Like me, right?
Laughing, she said,
God, you've been talking a mile a minute.
He shouted excitedly.
I'm explaining fascist theory of action.
She couldn't answer. It was too funny. But the man beside her did not think it was funny. He glowered at her, his face red. Veins in his forehead became distended, and he began once more to shake. And again he passed his fingers clutchingly along his scalp, forward and back, not speaking, only staring at her.
Don't get sore at me,
she said. For a moment she thought he was going to hit her. He drew his arm back. But then he grunted, reached and turned up the car radio. They drove on, band music from the radio, static. Once more she tried to concentrate on the book.
You're right, Joe said after a long time.
About what?
Two-bit empire, clown for a leader. No wonder we got nothing out of the war.
She patted his arm.
Giuliana, it's all darkness, Joe said. Nothing is true or certain, right?
Maybe so, she said absently, continuing to try to read.
Britain wins, Joe said, indicating the book. I save you the trouble. U.S. dwindles. Britain keeps needling and poking and expanding, keeps the initiative. So put it away.
I hope we have fun in Denver, she said, closing the book. You need to relax. I want you to.
If you don't, she thought, you're going to fly apart in a million pieces, like a bursting spring. And what happens to me then? How do I get back? And do I just leave you?
I want the good time you promised me, she thought. I don't want to be cheated. I've been cheated too much in my life before, by too many people.
We'll have it, Joe said. Listen.
He studied her with a queer, introspective expression.
You take it to that grasshopper book so much. I wonder, do you suppose a man who writes a bestseller, an author like that, Abinson, do people write letters to him? I bet lots of people praise his book by letters to him, maybe even visit.
All at once she understood.
Joe, it's only another 100 miles.
His eyes shone. He smiled at her, happy again, no longer flushed or troubled.
We could, she said. You drive so good, it'd be nothing to go on up there, would it?
Slowly, Joe said,
Well, I doubt a famous man lets visitors drop in. Probably so many of them. Why not try? Joe!
She grabbed his shoulder, squeezed him excitedly.
All he could do is send us away. Please?
With great deliberation, Joe said,
When we've gone shopping and got new clothes, all spruced up, that's important to make a good impression, and maybe even rent a new car up in Cheyenne. But you can do that.
Yes, she said.
And you need a haircut. And let me pick your clothes. Please, Joe. I used to pick Frank's clothes for him. A man can never buy his own clothes.
You got the good taste in clothes, Joe said, once more turning toward the road ahead, gazing out somberly. In other ways, too.
Better if you call him. Contact him. I'll get my hair done, she said.
Good. I'm not scared at all to walk up and ring the bell, Juliana said. I mean, you live only once. Why should we be intimidated? He's just a man like the rest of us. In fact, he probably would be pleased to know somebody drove so far just to tell him how much they liked his book. We can get an autograph on the book, on the inside, where they do that. Isn't that so? We better buy a new copy. This one is all stained. It wouldn't look good.
Anything you want, Joe said. I'll let you decide all the details. I know you can do it. Pretty girl always gets everyone. When he sees what a knockout you are, he'll open the door wide. But listen, no monkey business.
What do you mean?
You say we're married. I don't want you getting mixed up with him, you know. That would be dreadful. Wreck everyone's existence. Some reward for him to let visitors in. Some irony. So watch it, Juliana.
You can argue with him, Juliana said. That part about Italy losing the war by betraying them? Tell him what you told me.
Joe nodded. That's so. We can discuss the whole subject. They drove swiftly on.
At 7 o'clock the following morning, PSA reckoning, Mr. Nobusuke Togomi rose from bed, started toward the bathroom, then changed his mind and went directly to the Oracle. Seated cross-legged on the floor of his living room, he began manipulating the 49 yarrow stalks. He had a deep sense of the urgency of his questioning, and he worked at a feverish pace until at last he had the 6 lines before him. Shock. Hexagram 51. God appears in the sign of the arousing. Thunder and lightning. Sounds. He involuntarily put his fingers up to cover his ears. Ha-ha! Ho-ho! Great burst that made him wince and blink. Lizard scurries and tiger roars, and out comes God himself. What does it mean? He peered about his living room. Arrival of what? He hopped to his feet and stood panting, waiting. Nothing. Heart pounding. Respiration and all somatic processes, including all manner of diencephalic-controlled autonomic responses to crisis. Adrenaline, greater heartbeat, pulse rate, glands pouring, throat paralyzed, eyes staring, bowels loose et al., stomach queasy and sex instinct suppressed. And yet, nothing to see. Nothing for body to do. Run? All in preparation for panic flight. But where to and why? Mr. Togomi asked himself. No clue. Therefore impossible. Dilemma of civilized man, body mobilized but danger obscure. He went to the bathroom and began lathering his face to shave. The telephone rang. Shock, he said aloud, putting down his razor. Be prepared. He walked rapidly from the bathroom back into the living room.
I am prepared, he said and lifted the receiver.
Togomi here.
His voice squeaked, and he cleared his throat. A pause, and then a faint, dry, rustling voice, almost like old leaves far off, said,
Sir, this is Shinjiro Yatabe. I have arrived in San Francisco.
Greetings from the ranking trade mission, Mr. Togomi said. How glad I am. You are in good health and relaxed?
Yes, Mr. Togomi. When may I meet you?
Quite soon. In half an hour.
Mr. Togomi peered at the bedroom clock, trying to read it.
A third party, Mr. Baines. I must contact him. Possibly delay, but...
Shall we say 2 hours, sir?
Mr. Yatabe said.
Yes, Mr. Togomi said, bowing.
At your office in the Nippon Times building.
Mr. Togomi bowed once more. Click. Mr. Yatabe had rung off. Pleased Mr. Baines, Mr. Togomi thought. Delight on order of cat tossed piece of salmon, for instance, fatty nice tail. He jiggled the hook, then dialed speedily the Adhirati Hotel.
Ordeal concluded,
he said when Mr. Baines' sleepy voice came on the wire. At once the voice ceased to be sleepy.
He's here?
My office, Mr. Togomi said. 10:20. Goodbye. He hung up and ran back to the bathroom to finish shaving. No time for breakfast. Have Mr. Ramsey scuttle about after office arrival completed. All 3 of us perhaps can indulge simultaneously. In his mind, as he shaved, he planned a fine breakfast for them all. In his pajamas, Mr. Baines stood at the phone, rubbing his forehead and thinking.
A shame I broke down and made contact with that agent, he thought. If I had waited only one day more. But probably no harm has been done. Yet he was supposed to return to the department store today. Suppose I don't show up. It may start a chain reaction. They'll think I've been murdered or some such thing. An attempt will be made to trace me. It doesn't matter, because he's here, at last. The waiting is over. Mr. Baines hurried to the bathroom and prepared to shave. I have no doubt that Mr. Tagomi will recognize him the moment he meets him, he decided. We can drop the Mr. Yatabi cover now. In fact, we can drop all covers, all pretenses. As soon as he had shaved, Mr. Baines hopped into the shower. As water roared around him, he sang at the top of his lungs, Wer reizet zur Spat, durch Nacht und den Wind, es ist der Vater mit seinem Kind. It is probably too late now for the SD to do anything, he thought, even if they find out. So perhaps I can cease worrying, at least the trivial worry, the finite, private worry about my own particular skin. But as to the rest, we can just begin.